Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. We are so glad that you're joining us. Welcome to season 9 of the show. Yes, we've been doing this for 9 seasons, having the critical conversations and engaging the individuals who are leading us further down the road of progress, innovation, and transformation. As we kick off a new season, we are happily welcoming our 3 guests for a conversation that we haven't had in a very long time, but that deserves to be kept at the forefront as we pay homage to who we are, as we document our unique identities and examine the ties that bind us in the diaspora. University of the Bahamas is collaborating with partners to host the 40th West Indian Literature Conference and the 10th Critical Caribbean Symposium. But more importantly, is the very expanse of relevant topics that are being explored, themes that are timely, particularly as the Bahamas is moving closer to its 50th independence anniversary. Joining us are Dr. Michael Buckner, Professor of Black Studies at the University of Alberta in Canada, as well as Senior Editor of the Journal of West Indian Literature. We also have Chair of the School of English Studies at University of the Bahamas, Dr. Mayuri Dika, and Associate Professor of English in the School of English Studies at UB, Dr. Craig Smith. Welcome to you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Tamika. It's good to be here.
I'm curious, a lot has changed in the last 2 to 3 years, right? All kinds of disruptions and calamities. What's the impact of that on literature production and awareness?
If I should begin to respond, I think that the COVID pandemic definitely created disruptions, but it also created opportunities. I think that literary production continued. I think, for example, somebody like Olive Senior, a Jamaican-Canadian poet, who produced what she called pandemic poems, which are now in a collection. But what she was doing was producing like a poem almost every day or every other day, almost instantaneously recording what was happening around us. And so we now have a kind of archive, a poetic archive of response. There are in fact 3 collections called Pandemic Poems. So even the specificity of the moment of COVID has been responded to by artists. Artists are always responding to the world around them, and they find ways of articulating and find new platforms. And so as much as there was a disruption, people couldn't travel as much as they wanted to, the kind of live audiences, certain festivals couldn't happen. In the Caribbean, we have so many literary festivals taking place. The Calabash Festival in Jamaica was deferred, but Bocas went online, and Bocas had already had multiple ways of articulating and engaging. Bocas in Trinidad went online. And so I think the pandemic did create some disruptions, but at the same time, it created new opportunities. And I think people widened their audiences by having their online platforms for presentations.
Well, on that end too, I think one of the things that we did locally, Tamika, our Dustin Helberg, our creative writing professor, he came up with a program in terms of writing through trauma, because we know that a lot of people, you know, it was a traumatic experience for a lot of people. And so even taking their experiences of being locked down and getting people to write through that and, you know, work through that in creative ways, that was one way that we worked through that, and that created, you know, new works as well. And even in terms of the way we engage now, you know, through Zoom, we're in a Zoom call right now. And, you know, in certain ways, prior to the pandemic, you know, we were unknowingly cutting ourselves off from so many people who may not have been able to afford to travel and do some of those other things. But one of the events that we do with Blue Flamingo Literary Festival is poetry across voices across the diaspora, where we try to engage different writers from across the Caribbean and the US and Africa. And of course, that can get very expensive. And oftentimes the things that we would want to do, we couldn't have done because we couldn't afford it. But what the pandemic forced us to do was think about, okay, how can we make this happen? And, you know, Zoom was a godsend because it allowed us to connect with so many really important people that we otherwise may not have had the opportunity to meet and interact with and hear their work and so on. And so there were some positive things in the pandemic as well, in terms of literary production and creating community as well.
I was just going to add also that I think the pandemic created opportunities in terms of form of writing as well. Because as Michael is saying, that during the pandemic, people had to engage with different kinds of, not just psychological spaces, but also technical spaces, right? So it either enforced or out of creative expression, people started working with multiple platforms. And this actually creates an explosion of different genres and kinds of creativity that we have not seen or would not have seen had we not been in this space. So in that way, this has been an explosion of creative expression that is unlike anything that we have ever seen historically across the world. It has brought people together, but it has also created space for experimentation, for innovation. And I think there's also an acceptance in the audience for newer forms, right? Even in the classroom, like Craig is talking about, the workshops that Dr. Helberg did, right? Since we are on Zoom, since we are on the online platform, it has allowed our students to express themselves in ways that we have not done before. And that has also allowed them to express themselves in forms that we had not experimented with before. So in that sense, even with the trauma and the disruption, we have found ways to be creative. And there are ways in which people are expressing their experiences through innovation.
Yeah, the evolution has been quite fascinating, really. I don't want to make generalizations as I ask this question, but I can only speak in terms of my experience on this point. But, you know, sometimes when you say literature, some people are immediately dismissive. I don't quite know why that is, right? But do you find that that is the case? And why might that be? And how do we bridge that gap and get people to have a healthy appreciation for the role and relevance of literature to our very lives?
I think that's a kind of assumption that needs some kind of interrogation. You know, it's a repeated assumption, and I'm not so sure that people are as dismissive or people are as hesitant around literature. And I don't know what necessarily we mean by literature when we make that claim. To a large extent, I think the proliferation of literary festivals across the Caribbean in particular would suggest that there is an appetite for literature. Almost every Caribbean island now has a literary festival. That's one of the things I want to put on record. Secondly, we're still engaged and we love stories, and we have stories coming in all kinds of ways. Literature is not necessarily a book form. We have stories in film, and we have a huge film culture and a love of these stories. Further, I would make the point that some of the necessary skills for our moment, for now, critical thinking, the idea of being creative, problem solving, all of these things emerge in the study of literature. So I think that there is a kind of knee-jerk reaction, you know, where people are going to say, usually when they're thinking about professions or jobs, what are you going to do with literature? Are you just reading storybook, right? And so there can be that dismissive response in the sense of a kind of practical ideal. And yet the study of literature can serve so many professions. People are constantly looking for individuals with sharp research skills. Right now, almost every company has an online platform that requires content, that requires visual and verbal content. And the people who study literature and film are the ones with the kinds of skills. You know, I was told recently, maybe about not so recently, 10 years ago, when we had Banks come into the University of the West Indies at Mona to talk about the value of literature. We called the session Banking on Literatures in English. And the HR professional was able to tell us that oftentimes the people from banking are the ones without those skills, people skills, writing skills, relationship skills, analytic skills. And when they take the literature graduate and then teach them banking, which is usually easier than to try to teach a banker all these literary affective skills, that's where they found success. So I want to respectfully push back a little bit on this notion that literature is not an attractive field.
Mayuri?
Yeah, can I also add and pick up where Michael left about the soft skills that we are talking about, right? So generally, even the terminology of calling empathy-based effective skills that are required to not only exist in society at this point, but also to do well in business settings, right? These are skills that are called soft skills rather than the harder skills of what you would assume. I'll use the same example as banking would require. And generally, even the terminology kind of marginalizes these people skills, right? As if they are less important than knowing how to do hard quantitative skills. And I think that is also an assumption that needs to be pushed back. And across businesses in the world, we are seeing that pushback because businesses are realizing that it is only employees that are with soft skills who are better employees and can engage and learn the hard skills as they go along. And I think literature, the humanities, are the disciplines that give these soft skills. Because, I mean, think about it, right? The Caribbean is a storytelling culture, right? We are a culture, the Bahamas is a culture that is based in oral storytelling, right? The way people speak is a part of those stories. And to study those, and not just, as Michael pointed out, textbooks, because I think when people say, you know, literature, they assume it is only written text. And a lot of times that it is only a specific kind of writer you're reading, or it is a specific kind of genre you're reading. But if you look at literature departments across the world and what we study, the concept of the text has exploded, right? It is no longer just the written text. We study oral text, we study oral text, we study visual text. And so for most of our literature classes at the university, Tamika, you know, we study along with the written text, we study visual text, we study hybrid text as well. So when we talk about literature, I think that assumption needs to be exploded as well at what is a text. It is no longer a simplistic definition that can be put in a box and said it is only this kind of a modality that is written by this sort of people.
Can I interject to my, I believe too, sometimes with that, because let's be honest, and you know, students come to my class and they do say, oh, I can't stand literature, right? Or I don't like to read or whatever. And I think that what happens often though is As Mahira is pointing out, you know, it may be the literature that they are exposed to and how they come to the literature in high school, in their high school experiences. And so I think too, you know, getting it back to West Indian Lit Conference and or even the Blue Flamingo Literary Festival, I think a lot of times when we're in high school or junior high school, the kinds of texts that we are exposed to, we don't necessarily often connect with in real ways. And so I think that's why something like the West Indian Lit Conference, something like the Blue Flamingo Literary Festival, because the idea around that is that we are writing our stories, right? We're telling our stories. And it's important for Bahamian people, for Caribbean people to read themselves. You know, one of the reasons why Black Panther was so big, right, was because of representation, because, you know, Black people, African-Americans in particular, saw something that they could connect to in a real sort of way in ways that they hadn't been able to connect before, right? And so, you know, representation in literature is also important. Representation, seeing the Caribbean experience, seeing the Bahamian experience, and, you know, sort of making that very, that connection. And yes, we can connect with Jane Austen and even Shakespeare, but at the same time, reading of about ourselves, right? That is important. I think that we may become a little bit more invested in that. And so that's why something like the West Indian Lit Conference, where we are studying and where we are talking about and we're engaging West Indian Lit, Caribbean Lit, Bahamian Lit, right? And people can see themselves in their diversity as well, because the Caribbean experience is not a monolith either, right? And so even seeing the diversity, if you look at the panels that we are going to be presenting at the West Indian Lit, we're looking at Caribbean people in the future, we're looking at queer studies, we're looking at women's studies, we're looking at masculinities, we're looking at climate change as it relates to literature. So it runs the gamut in terms of what we can say about ourselves. And I think that when people are exposed to that and they understand that, they will become a little bit more engaged as well.
I'm glad I decided to ask that question up front, because I think that the enlightenment and the context that you provided were very much needed as we transition and get into the meat and potatoes of the West Indian Lit Conference and the Critical Caribbean Symposium. This is actually a very good spot to take our first break, everyone. I know you can't wait for us to come back, so we'll take our first break and be back after this. You're listening to University Drive.
My name is Tracy Thompson, and I am here as a Wilson Award grant recipient. My research publication is called That Black Men Could Rule. With the rise of European power over the past 500 years or so against the Arabs, and then over time against other opponents, has come the rise of an ideology. That ideology maintains that whiteness has special value, and that people who possess this particular property can lay claim to a higher level of humanity. That perspective, in turn, has led to what can only be called a sustained assault on the idea of blackness. And part of that assault has taken the form of claims that black men cannot think. And if black men can think, they cannot feel. And that if black men can feel, they do not care. And these stereotyped claims have been muted in the past 50 years or so. But they are experiencing a resurgence. I hope that the study demonstrates that the university can continue to produce intellectual products of global caliber.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to fuel Bahamian research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
Welcome back to University Drive. Our guests are Dr. Michael Buckner, Dr. Mayuri Dika, and Dr. Craig Smith, who are all involved in the 40th West Indian Literature Conference and the Critical Caribbean Symposium. The event is going to be happening at University of the Bahamas in October. Earlier, when we were having our conversation, I wanted to ask, so I'll ask it here now, what do we mean when we say literature? Let's just clarify that. What do we mean when we say that?
I think that is a question that will get million answers, Tamika, because as we were just talking, that the concept of literature has become revolutionary in a sense, right? And so the assumptions that literature would be a one kind of text that spoke to a certain audience or was by written by a certain audience is now exploding. So we have literature from multiple perspectives written in many, many different modalities. So when we are talking about literature, and I think the conference is a very good example to showcase how we are redefining what literature means, because we'll be talking not only about novels and poems and the traditional forms of literature, but also about visual texts, about oral texts, about poetry, and about multimedia texts as well. So if I had to define what literature is, I would say it's a form of human expression that connects us to the world and expresses our unique experience as we navigate this world in whatever form it is.
I can see Michael agreeing with that, right?
Yes, I have to agree with that. Many people think of literature as having several forms, and this is where you get into genres. So there's poetry, there's drama, there's prose fiction, there are stories. But the other way in which we've been thinking about literature is that these forms are not just tied to the verbal economy, meaning words. And so we have also seen literature having the expansiveness into verbal texts. Yesterday I was talking to a colleague who's doing a course on sound and the ways in which sound technology is another kind of source of putting together certain kinds of forms. At the University of the West Indies Mona campus, we've had a course on reggae poetry, where we're looking at the creative expression in music as a form of study. And we're looking at the poetry of those things. And it's interesting how that allows us to think about what's happening in our societies. How do we look at these forms of creative expression that map the history and social arrangements and the politics of our day? We have had somebody at the West Indian Literature Conference like Gordon Rolaire, who started a kind of a research on Calypso and what does Calypso mean for Caribbean societies. And so literature is a kind of creative expression that is shaped in variety of forms that will reflect the life of people. You know, and I think that expansive notion of literature, therefore, you know, people's life writing, people are writing about their own individual stories. And there are so many huge stories that come across. For example, I was the public orator of the University of the West Indies, in which I had to do citations. And those citations were, in fact, creative accounts of important and significant contributions by individuals to our societies. You know, that is also literature.
I was reading the call for papers and I was fascinated because of the areas that were itemized there. Discourse on things like imaging/imagining the green economy in the Caribbean region, LGBTQI representation in politics, the creative arts and culture, creative practices and productions in the wake of neo-colonialism, representing trauma in contemporary literature and art, digital diasporas and new knowledge centers, education in the virtual space. I mean, and there's so much more. How did you come up with these kinds of themes?
Well, I mean, that's what That's what's happening in the field right now, right? We didn't necessarily come up with that. That's what's going on. One of the things I just wanted to piggyback on the early conversation in terms of that idea of what is literature. And, you know, I can't do any better than what my two colleagues have presented. But I think oftentimes for many lay people, at least, or maybe some of our students, when we think about literature, right, that big word, we think Dostoevsky, we think Shakespeare, we think Bronte, right? These European folks who were writing way back when, right? And so I think that one of the things that what we are trying to do, and even with these titles, right, that we've come up with, you know, literature in the green economy, in terms of thinking about things that are really relevant and important to us now, and what are our young people interested in? We offer courses in children's literature, right? So studying Peter Pan and The Little Mermaid and those kinds of texts, studying Marvel Comics or, you know, other graphic novels and so on. So all those are now a part of the conversation when we're talking about literature. You can get a degree studying graphic novels, right? And, you know, a lot of people may think that, oh, well, that's just, you know, what is that? How do we construct a career around those? But that's the same sort of feedback we get when we talk about oral traditions, because I teach a class in Bahamian oral traditions, right? And, well, you know, y'all talking about Buki Barabi and, you know, Buki Barabi and Shine or whatever, how is that useful? But it's really important because, again, those are stories in whatever forms, these narratives, these stories tell us who we are, right? And in studying these stories, like Mayuri is pointing out, it teaches us empathy. It teaches us how we are similar, how we are different from other people. It teaches us how to interact and how to engage with each other, right? And so I think that when we think about literature and the power of literature, it is very diverse and it can open all sorts of fields for us to move forward and take beyond just the classroom as well.
Just wanted to add that literary critics are also researchers, and we are concerned about contemporary issues, the issues of the environment, for example, which is one of those topics that you will see there, is urgent. Mm-hmm. It's urgent. And our voices, what we recognize is that creative artists are also contemplating these issues. And so part of what literary critics will do in their own research is to find out what are the ways in which solutions are being imagined, what are the ways in which the contextualization of the issues are being done through our creative artists, and to offer these, you know, as a kind of think tank around some of these urgent and current issues. And I think that we play a role in, although we're not like the social sciences, that our research can go directly to policy, we're creating a kind of thinking, conceptual environment in which we can imagine, we can detail, we can tease out some of the solutions for our contemporary world. And some of them are legacies of the past. So the term neocolonialism, one of the larger kind of heavy dominant theoretical space that we have to interrogate is that of the colonial era. And we're still unpacking some of those things. And that's part of how we feel that a society can move forward.
What I'm hearing is it is absolutely imperative for us to continue to create platforms and opportunities and spaces for us to have these kinds of conversations, right?
Absolutely. And I just wanted to also say, along with what Craig and Michael have said, that literature, along with giving us a platform to express ourselves, is also history, right? It defines and creates awareness of who we are as a people. And as we talk about these issues that are so pertinent, so important at this point in history, literature is the way to look back and learn from the lessons of the past, because so much of the oral storytelling is lessons from the past, the history that we have been handed. And we make those connections to our present so that our futures are better, right? So literature gives us that platform of not only being the container of history in a way, but also being that platform, that thread that connects us from the past to the present to the future. And that's why you see all the themes of the conference are socially aware themes, right? These are themes about issues that affect us in the present time. And even looking at what is happening with Hurricane Ian right now, it shows us how important it is to talk about these issues, because these are all connected issues.
And Mayuri, not to overemphasize the point too, but I think the point you made as well in terms of literature helps us to imagine the future, right? And the theme of this year's conference is the future of West Indian literature, right? And so I think that we can't, you know, gloss over that in terms of thinking about the future. I mean, if we just look at our experiences today, we are talking about literature and in the field, we study film and television and novels and whatnot. And just thinking about the future, you think back to, I don't know, I may be dating myself, but remember watching Star Trek on television and they were on.
Have no memory of that, Craig.
I'm sure. There's some old files that I can send to you, Michael, to catch you up.
Are they on like those video cassettes?
Right? Is that the Wakanda version of Star Trek?
But the idea, you know, when we think about those things, when they spoke on their phasers or whatever, their talky things, you know, that's our cell phone. When they would talk on their intercoms and they would basically FaceTime, you know, each other, that was years before the technology, was created. But, you know, we had the imagination to write those things, to think about what is possible. And those things that we, you know, thought were possible back in the 50s and 60s, those are realities today. And so just imagine what we can do when we start writing and imagining a future, right? And we can bring those things to fruition. So again, literature, it's very important. It's very significant to the past, definitely on the present, but also very much in terms of thinking about our future and how our future can be different, than the past.
So tell us about what can we expect for the conference? What are your plans? What can we expect? And what are you intending to do with all of the information that will be generated at this conference?
Well, as Michael pointed out, the conference in the past has been sort of the ground where we get papers for the journal, right, Michael? Is that still something that we work towards, right? Because again, it's oftentimes with these conferences, we don't get as many people in, or, you know, people can't travel or people can't tune in. And so one of the ways that we can get some of this information out is through publication. And so often there are journals like J. Will and others that publish either the conference proceedings, or folks will, the papers are about 15-minute presentations, 20-minute presentations. And so after the conference, what happens, it's a bit of a think tank as well, right? People often present works, ideas that they're working on. And because they're in a room full of other people, they get feedback in terms of where they can possibly take their work. And, you know, maybe another few months after the conference, you'll see the work in its finished form published in one of the academic journals. So that's definitely one of the goals that we want to achieve from the conferences, to definitely get out some publications.
If I could just add to that yes, there are journals like Ansiorium that comes out of the University of Miami. We are a kind of coalition of various English departments, the conference began with the three main campuses of the University of the West Indies. And in fact, the first conference was not even held in Barbados, Trinidad, or Jamaica. It was held at the University of the Virgin Islands. And so we have always had an expansive notion, even though it began with colleagues at the University of the West Indies. And it has expanded to include University of Puerto Rico. It has included the University of Bahamas. It includes the University of Miami. And from time to time, we go to other sites where there might not be a university, and even others that might have a university, like St. George's University in Grenada. We've been to Antigua and St. Lucia and so on. So part of it is this coalition, and there has been a relationship between the conference and the Journal of West Indian Literature, which emerged about 7 years after the first conference as a space to kind of provide a publishing platform for or researchers in the Caribbean. And as a consequence, we have now even gone online, and therefore it has an even wider platform for these papers. So Anthurium, Caribbean Quarterly, and the Journal of West Indian Literature have been sites where publications have been made and done, and sometimes there have been book publications that have come out of these conferences. So the knowledge is being shared and circulated and responded to. And just to quickly say that it has been a place of shifting. In the 1997 conference, for example, there was a paper done called Critics in the Dark that challenged the critical environment about the ways in which we did not pay attention to queer subjects and issues around sexuality. It was really a seismic shift in a similar way to when Dion Brand at a Caribbean Women Writers Conference challenged them about the silencing around those issues. And, you know, we've had, you know, interventions about the environment or interventions about other kinds of issues through these conferences. And so that's part of the relationship. And therefore, that's a space in which some of the sharing of knowledge will take place.
So tell us the dates exactly where at UB the conference is being held, and how can the public participate?
All right, so the dates are October 13th to the 15th. As of right now, all of the panel discussions will be at the Frankie Wilson Building. So we have three spaces in there. The public can go to our website. If they go to the UB website, they will see our banner, and they can just click on the banner, and then they can register on that site. I think there's a conference day rate. I can't remember what it is right now. But the general public is open. Our panels start at 9 a.m. in the morning, and we go until about 6 p.m. on the Thursday, and about until 4:30 on the Friday, and then until 12 on the Saturday. We also will be hosting a social event at the NAGB on Friday evening, a little cocktail reception. And I want to point out too that this is an interdisciplinary endeavor. So School of English is working with social sciences. We're working with the art department. One of the things that we plan to have, one of the features, is we're actually going to have a art exhibit as a part of our event. And so, as you know, Tamika, at the first floor of Frankie Wilson is actually an art gallery studio space. And so we are going to be partnering with the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, and they will lend us some of their pieces. And so Michael will curate an exhibit as a part of the event as well. So we have a lot of different things going on to make it dynamic and interesting. And remember, we have guests coming in from the Caribbean and Canada and the US, and as far as Japan, I believe, right? And so it's a very diverse group of people who are coming in. And so we definitely want them to experience what UB has to offer, what Nassau has to offer, what the Bahamas has to offer in terms of our art, in terms of our food, in terms of our literature, in terms of our culture in general. So we want to make it a sort of holistic experience for the people who come here.
Could I also add that this conference is hybrid because one of the objectives of the conference was to connect as many diverse groups of people as possible. So the conference is hybrid for graduate students and for locals, the conference rate is $50. And for UB students, the conference is free.
Okay, very good, very good. It is shocking how time flies, but we have to take another break, everyone. But I'm sure our listeners will stay tuned and stay connected. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Sonia Farmer, and I'm a 2022 Wilson Award grant recipient. So my research project is called Indelible, and it's an oral history archive documenting experiences with and within citizenship, with and within the Bahamas. And this project is composed of three parts. Overall, it's a digital humanities project, but there is an oral history archive, which contains testimonies engaging with experiences with citizenship in this country. The second part is a collaborative art project where the participants also complete an altered voter's card however they would like. And the third component is an educational framework which provides toolkits so that we can engage with the crisis of citizenship in this country. So even though I'm coordinating this project and I've conceptualized this project, it's really primarily a collaborative project. I will be working with at least 50 different people speaking to me about their experiences with citizenship to make up this oral history archive. And I will also be working with historians, artists, human rights lawyers, and many other folks to create educational frameworks on the website as well so that we can engage with the history of citizenship and the current reality of citizenship. So it's really a collaborative project and I'm really excited to be bringing everyone together to examine what it means to be Bahamian.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to Fuel Bahamian Research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
Welcome back, everyone, to University Drive. We're talking about West Indian literature and specifically the conference coming up at University of the Bahamas in October and Critical Caribbean Conversations. So I read the call for papers and presentations, and one of the things that stood out for me is what was posited, which is that as Caribbean futures continue to be yoked to tourism and extractive and consumptive practices, the political and social needs of local residents are overlooked, often in favor of tending to visitors. How do literary scholars, West Indian writers, tackle these realities? Why is that an important context for this conference? Let's talk about that and what the approach and what obtained before the most recent global disasters and what obtains now. Has the paradigm shifted, you think?
I don't think that the paradigm, not really. I mean, so one of the, I would say one of the foremost texts that comes out of the Bahamas that sort of engages these issues is our very own Ian Strawn's Paradise and Plantation, right? Where he talks about the tourist economy within the Caribbean space in the Bahamas specifically, and the problems that obtain within that particular system in the way that it's engaged now. And so I believe that that was true when Ian wrote his book, and I believe that that is still true in many ways. It was this week when the Prime Minister of the Bahamas actually was given a speech, right, internationally, and talking about the ways in which Black-run Caribbean nations specifically are held to a particular standard, right, that may in many ways be hinged on some of those same old, right? The ways in which Black folks and these Black countries are used by our neighbors to the north, right? Europe and Canada and the United States in particular. And so I think that we still have a long ways to go in sort of finding equality and finding our own voice and finding our own footing as people in the Caribbean. And I think the way that we engage with the tourist economy has to be, you know, we have to engage with that in certain ways. And also, even as I think Michael pointed out earlier, you know, we're thinking about the environment and the ways in which that our environment in the Caribbean is affected by, and oftentimes that by issues that aren't even within our hands, right? Whatever they do over there affects us and affects us in more drastic ways than it does over there. And so in terms of our discussions or some of the discussions that we have, engage in those kind of ideas about the way we are affected and how we can find our voice and our footing in this discussion.
I just want to add that I think there has been a lot of work done around urgencies and relationships between the environment, tourism, and that capitalist extractive economy. And to say that we're not isolated in that work. I think at the Mona campus, there's a climate studies group led by Professor Michael Taylor. And the work of creative artists, people like Olive Senior, for example, who I've mentioned before. She has a poem called Rejected Text for a Tourist Brochure, in which she shows the ways in which there's kind of damage, you know, ironically say, come see my land before the particles of busy fires ascend, before the rivers descend underground, before coffee plantations grind the mountains into dust, before the coral dies, before the beaches disappear. You know, she has been a significant voice in the Caribbean about ecological damage and problems. And as Poet Laureate of Jamaica currently, she's also been emphasizing the environment as part of her mandate. So what we're saying is that creative artists, there have been a number of documentaries, for example, recently in Jamaica put out by Esther Figueroa, who showcases the urgencies of this work. So creative artists are being connected to activist work and the urgencies around these issues. And we see this as another place to retool ourselves, refocus in terms of what critical work can do in respect to these issues.
When we are expressing creatively about social issues that are urgent, like the environment, and it is in a problem solution critical perspective, right? And we see more and more of the creative cultural critical work coming out of literature. You know, we had that question about literature being dismissed, but so much of the work has activism that is inherent in it. In fact, not too long ago, professors from UB, our own Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett and Jessica Minnis and Sophia Roll published their book, Tourism Development, Governance and Sustainability in the Bahamas. And one of the things that they looked at was not just tourism's effect on the socio-cultural environmental aspects of life, but also on the psychological aspects of the people who are working within that business. And that is something that is not talked about a whole lot. What is the impact of working in an industry that is so capitalistic and customer forward, right? And as an economy that is based almost entirely on such an economic platform, what are the impacts psychologically for the servers, the people who are working in it day in and day out? So those are also concerns that we do talk about. And this conference is really going to be that think tank to think about issues like this.
The thing about think tanks, I'm sitting here listening and I'm thinking to myself, how do you bridge what may be a gap between the thoughts, the expressions, the critical conversations that are happening and perhaps an impacting policy? Is that a gap?
I think that's a very important question, Tamika. And that is actually a question that most of us grapple with in one way or another, right? Because it's well and good to have these thoughts, but the impact really is when it is put into practice. But going back to a conversation about why literature is important, part of the work that literary critics and people who are expressing themselves do is to imagine that future, is to think about these solutions, is to present it to people in ways where they are able to think about it themselves, think about it critically themselves, and to think about solutions on their own or to accept what is being presented. So that is a part of the praxis as well. So that imagination, which connects the person who is the artist expressing themselves with the audience, with the people, the lay people, I don't want to call them lay people, but the people who are their readers, is also putting that germ of possibility in their minds for change. But outside of that, I already had mentioned before that our department and UB is very socially conscious, and we do many projects that are community outreach projects. And Craig mentioned one of them, which was Shakespeare Behind Bars. And that is a way in which we make thought into praxis, where we are bringing what our conceptualized ideas are to actually affecting change in some little way.
I want to add that I've been part of a number of transnational research groups. I'm on the board for one now that's looking at gender-based violence. And that research practice is not just about finding statistics or having theories or having case studies, but also at the end of it, having portions of the study that would be applied to take a particular literal historical context. One of them is to begin with the youth. And so there is a project, one of the gender-based violence projects that I'm a part of, would go into schools and do workshops and have creative expressions as a response to gender-based violence, working towards shifting people's consciousness, shifting the ideas. Ideas around masculinities, for example, require a lot of interrogation and unpacking, and to suggest new ways of being a man in the Caribbean that will take away from engaging in gender-based violence, for example. But also at the end of it, to provide certain kinds of recommendations. And therefore, some of that work will involve the work of researchers engaging in civil society, where civil society can also shift government policies. And sometimes we might believe that shifting government policy is really the impact, the real impact. But sometimes, even when the government policy has changed, people's consciousness will remain the same. And without shifting that consciousness, without sharing a new vision of understanding of how we relate to each other, which is a longer, slower process, that shift in policy is not going to have as much teeth or value without a shift in that. So there are multiple layers of this work. The work that begins with the creative artist, with the researchers who are trying to put everything together, with some kind of social activism, but also with shifting policy. But large part of that is shifting how we think about our relationships to these issues and how we can change. How can we change? How can we engage not only civil society, but even the capitalist economy, these businesses, to see that there's some value in changing how we do things? How do we transform our societies into green economies, for example, and get everybody on board? And it's a multi-layered set of work that might begin here, but will have several steps afterwards. And more research groups and research collectives are engaged in this kind of multi-layered work, the Bahamas.
Very good. We're almost flat out of time. I will reserve the last couple of minutes for Craig as he gives the wrap up and also reminds our listeners about exactly how they can participate in the West Indian Literature Conference and Critical Caribbean Symposium.
So Tamika, I just wanted to point out, I know we've been talking a lot about our international folks coming in and the importance of internationalization and so on, but I do want people to know that we are local focused as well. And one of our keynote, actually our first keynote speaker is Patricia Glinton McCullis, who is a luminary in the Bahamas, Bahamian literature and culture, right? And so she'll be presenting, she'll be opening the conference with her keynote address. And so, you know, we are very much invested in the international, but also the local as well. And so I just wanted to make that point so folks understand that we are grounded within the Bahamas as well, right? As well as the rest of the diaspora as well. But again, the conference begins on Thursday, October 13th, and it goes until Saturday, October 15th. Panels begin at 9 a.m. and they go through the morning and the late afternoon. And they can visit the UBE webpage, homepage, and on the homepage, they will find the banner and they can click on the banner and they can be led to the registration page. If that's confusing, they can just show up on the day and we will be there to help them out, to show them how to get to the different panels and be a part of the discussion. But we want people to come out. We want our students to come out. We want the general public to come out if they can, you know, take an early or a late lunch break. Our draft program will be online. And so if they're curious, they can just go on and look at the draft programs and find the panel or the panels that they might be interested in. And so they can just mark their calendar now so they know when they want to take time off so they can come and be a part of the panel discussion that interests them.
Good. Well, thank you all for joining us for this very first show of season 9 of University Drive. Dr. Michael Buckner, Dr. Mayuri Dika, and Dr. Craig Smith. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And you have an open invitation to join us. Craig will be joining us in his capacity as our visiting host from time to time. Thank you so much for agreeing to that. Remember to follow University of the Bahamas news and connections by visiting www.ub.edu.bs. Like, follow, subscribe, and all connect with us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok, YouTube, and all of our channels across social media. I've been your host, Tamika Lundy. Thank you so much for listening to University Drive. University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.